Welcome to Nexus 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode of Nexus 818 Podcast features the Montford Point Marines. After 144 years of exclusion due to segregation, approximately 20,000 African American men were admitted to the Marine Corps. For their valiant service to our nation, these Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in November of 2011. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out episode 27 from October the 4th of 2023 to learn more about the background of the Montford Point Marines. I am pleased to welcome to episode 34 the descendants of First Sergeant Nolan Ambrose Marshall, who served in the Montford Point Marines. My guests tonight are Allison Marshall and Nolan Marshall Jr., sons of First Sergeant Nolan Marshall Sr. Welcome, Allison and Nolan.
Thank you.
I always like to start with a few interesting facts. This is about your dad. First, Nolan Sr. was in the first group of Blacks to be accepted in the United States Marine Corps. Second, at age 20, he was promoted to the esteemed rank of First Sergeant. And third, he was the highest ranking Black Marine in the U.S. Marine Corps serving in the South Pacific at that time. That's pretty impressive. So let's talk a little bit about your dad, Nolan Ambrose Marshall Sr.
Never call him senior.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, because even though he's not with us right now, he still may have something to say about that. I've been calling him. I'm going to call him senior here, only to make a distinction between you and him. Sometimes, so he'll have to pardon me for that. So he was. Let's talk about him. He was born in New Orleans in 1924. How old was he when he enlisted?
19.
Okay. What was he doing at the time of enlistment?
I don't know. Al, do you know?
From what I understand, prior to being enlisted, he was during the summer breaks, he was employed by a carpenter by his stepfather, Albert Pazon, during summer breaks and after high school.
Okay. Did he ever talk about why he decided to enlist? Any sense of?
He mentioned to me that he was just gung-ho at the time. And that's all he said. He didn't say much, but I do remember him saying he was gung-ho.
Did his parents have any reaction, or did he ever share those? Did you know your grandparents?
I did know them, but I'd never heard anything, whether I didn't hear them mention anything about that at all. Nolan, you may know more about that than I do.
No, we never had a conversation about it.
So it was a very difficult time for African-Americans in the 40s. It's said that Black soldiers had to fight on a two-front battle, victory from enemies without and a victory over our enemies at home. It was quite an act of valor under those circumstances to enlist. What do you think made him so special?
Only thing I can think of is that he just felt that it was something that he needed to do. That's the only thing that comes to my mind.
Well, you know, when you're in a neighborhood, you may not get along with everybody in the neighborhood, but nobody outside of the neighborhood better not come to try and destroy your neighborhood. I mean, that's the sense that I had of it.
So protecting the homeland.
Yes, you know, it was his home. It is our home, and regardless of how we treat it. It's still our home. It's like you can have a argument with your brother and your sister or whatever, but nobody else better not try and mess with them, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's more that than anything else.
It's always intriguing, you know, the more I listen and read about what was going on in the 40s, late 30s and 40s, it's always fascinating that, you know, that the Black folks decided to enlist. They were the ones who weren't drafted, but they eagerly decided that they wanted to try to serve the country. despite how the country treated us. And I just find that intriguing. I'm not sure we see a lot of the same thing today, but yeah. You know. So I know that your dad was a first sergeant. What was his specialty in the Marines?
Well, I think his specialty was leading and commanding the other troops. He became a drill sergeant, and I think that was his specialty. Leading other men.
I'm pretty amazed at age 20, which is just basically a year after he had enlisted, that he was promoted to, he got several promotions and was already a first sergeant. That speaks to the issue of leadership. And go ahead.
You'd have to know his mother.
Tell me about that. Tell me better.
Well,
in the context of that comment.
Well, he was ever bit his mother in terms of detail, taking charge. You know, she ran a house that way. You know, everything was spotless. Everything had a place. She was very much like military.
Okay, so that definitely prepared him. A place for everything and everything in this place?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And he had to make his bed also every day?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah, he probably had to learn a new way to make it in the service, because the military had their own way of making the bed. But, you know, he was off to a good start when he enlisted. And do you know, can you think of any interesting stories that he shared about his time in the service, any adventures or painful or scary or funny memories?
The only ones I can think of was when he was, I guess, being responsible as a drill sergeant. He would have people, sometimes if they got out of line, he would, and I hope this, I'm saying it verbatim, he would have guys stand on the barracks and say, cock-a-doodle-doo, I am a shitbird. Now that's one thing that he passed on to me. I couldn't help but laugh at the time.
So what is that? I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I guess, you know, if someone really screwed up bad,
okay,
you know, if you didn't, and I'm sure that, you know, you're a Marine first and whatever your specialty was later. And they said that he said that they were stretcher bearers and they were primarily there for support. However, they were trained to fight. And I guess when the invasion of Peleliu came to be, you couldn't be stretcher bearers anymore. You had to be part of the invading force. And if you you have to have a certain amount of discipline, and there's no doubt about it. That's what you have to have. And I guess, you know, before you're part of a deploying force, hopefully that discipline is instilled in you one way or another. And if you had to be disciplined, then one way to do it is to admit. Force a soldier to admit that, okay, I screwed up, and that's one way to do it.
So what is a stretcher bearer?
Basically picking up dead bodies.
Okay. Okay.
I tell you, you know, what I remember is his days as a drill sergeant. And how bad of a man he had to be. He had to be one bad mother, you know, because if you knew him, he was about 6'2", and might have weighed 148 pounds or something like that. He was a beanpole, but he had to own it. And he had to be the meanest, baddest man in there to get to where he wanted to be. He wanted to be the top dog.
Okay.
And he was always that way. He had to be the best of everything. The best of everything. Go first class everywhere. That's who he was.
Okay.
And he reminded me of the times he said he got in a ring for much bigger people than him. And
in boxing?
Oh yeah. And that's just who he was. I remember there was a councilman here, James Gray, an attorney, and he was an ex-Marine as well. And I think you, in your podcast and talks, I'm sure you've come across Sergeant Major Huff.
Not yet, but I'm sure Mallory hasn't lined up for, family lined up for me.
You have not. No one has talked to you about Sergeant Major Huff?
No, not yet.
Well, he was in my father's platoon, and he was the one that stayed in and went through many different Vietnam. He went through so many different things with the Marines till he became a Sergeant Major. And James Gray reminds me of the conversation that he overheard. Sergeant Major Huff was talking to this general, and they were discussing who was the baddest Marine. And James Gray walked up during that conversation. He said, "I know the two baddest Marines that were ever in the Marines." And the colonel wanted to know, "Well, who are you referring to? If you're not referring to me," he said, "Well, of course I'm the baddest Marine ever." He said, "But second to me had to been my drill sergeant, Sergeant Major, First Sergeant Nolan Marshall." He thought he was the second baddest Marine ever. And then I remember him visiting my father at a place called Mason's on Claiborne Avenue. And boy, to hear those guys talk was phenomenal. Of course, he had a guy named Van Davis that my father hired. He was a Marine, and he had taken some shrapnel in the face, so he had some scarring in the face. But he was still built like a Marine in that Marine condition, and my father hired him. And whenever we wanted to get out of work, we'd mention Marines. and get those two to talk about their experiences in the Marine. And all we had to do then is be an audience and sit there. And we didn't have to do any more work. But those were experiences he cherished. He tried to get me to enlist when I was a freshman in college during the Vietnam War. And he thought I should have enlisted in the Marines. That would have been a great experience for me. Of course, my girlfriend and my mother had other thoughts. And so I did not enlist. And as a matter of fact, I had a friend that came home from Vietnam. I told him I was thinking about dropping out and enlisting. And he told me if he did, he'd beat my ass. So, but from the three of them, I didn't enlist. So I never had the opportunity to serve.
Well, they're serving in many different ways. So.
Yeah.
So I understand that your dad was a photographer and an entrepreneur. I'd like to hear more about what he did when he completed his military service, education, career, community activism, any of those areas.
Well, he was all over the place, socially, civically, and as an entrepreneur. He came out of the service and went to college. He spent 3.5 years in college.
And where was that?
Xavier University.
Okay.
And just before he finished his career, they offered him a job in accounting at Dillard University. But he had to start in January, which meant he had to leave Xavier and take that full-time job, which he did. He took the full-time job of running the finance department at Dillard University. And he stayed there a few years, but thought that wasn't for him. It wasn't satisfying. And he went to work for a company called Sackett's, who was the top photography company in the city at the time.
Do they still exist now?
Oh, no. He stayed there, I think, 2 or 3 years till he learned everything he needed to know about photography, and then started out on his own. And everything happened from that perspective. he became a photographer, married my mother, had three children, and then they got divorced and married Allison's mother. But during that period of time, he went from photography. There was a guy in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that was a representative for the LG Balfour Company that sold class rings, caps and gowns, and graduation paraphernalia. And he knew Potter, and Potter knew him. And they each, they agreed to work, to help each other. He would help my father get business in Baton Rouge as a photographer, and my father would help him get business selling class rings. That didn't work out too well. So what they did is my father taught him photography, and he got him on with Balfour. And they grew their business to dominate in their cities, in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And then Balfour gave them each additional territory, which amounted to half the state of Louisiana. And my father grew that to have over 100 schools under contract in the state of Louisiana, from the Gulf Coast of Louisiana all the way to the Arkansas border, Lake Providence, Griffin, Monroe, and then he came down all the way through Acadiana and Lafayette area. So he had over 100 schools. He had started calling on schools in Baton Rouge, not Baton Rouge, in Mississippi, and he had a school in Alabama, and was trying to get the territory in the panhandle of Florida when integration occurred. But he was quite successful. I don't know if you know it, Al, but he was the first salesman in the industry to do what we call package selling. Meaning that he sold as a package. He didn't sell the ring and then the cap and gown and everything separately. He put it all in a package, and the students could choose package A, B, or C, or call it the senior, deluxe, the graduate, or collegiate when he got fancy and had names for them. My first time I went on the road was the year before the schools integrated. And we traveled up through Mississippi to the Arkansas border, and that's where we would start. We would take the orders in their junior year, which were game was unheard of. Everything was done in the senior year. Mm-hmm. He was the first to do it in the junior year, because doing it that way, the packages were more expensive. And he figured out he would give them a payment plan where he'd take the orders in their junior year, in January or February of their junior year. And then he would send them payment cards, and they would mail in payments on a monthly basis. And then when their senior year came, everything was paid for, and he just had to deliver everything. Hmm. Now, this is back when computers were just getting started, and they had punch cards,
right,
with a big machine that was almost table size, where you sit there with a stack of cards in the machine, and you'd punch each person's information. And he rented time on the mainframe computer down at the Fry Meatpacking Company, because they were only one of the few that even had computers back then. And he would take all of his punch card boxes, punch cards, to the place, and they would process those cards, print out computer statements for him, and print out the payment forms for the students. So he was in the top 10 in the industry when the integration happened. Yeah. And all of the students were, back then, the principals of the high schools made the most money. And then next down from there was the middle schools, and down from there was elementary schools. Well, when integration happened in the state of Louisiana and many states in the South, they demoted the black high school principal down to the middle school and kept the white principal as the high school principal. And they sent all of the black students over to the formerly all white high school. Of course, none of the white kids stayed in the school. So pretty much the public school system became all black. But the white principal was, they maintained that their jobs as the principal and made the black principal the principal of the middle school. And the white principals, the students didn't know whether or not to order from us in their junior year or not, because the next year they were going to a different school. And so when we got there, everything was planned and scheduled, and we were supposed to take their pictures and take their orders for the rings and all of that stuff. And I think I was 19 at the time. And they didn't want to, they were skeptical about placing the orders because they didn't know what was going to happen the next year. And so we would have had to go home without taking any orders. And I asked Eddie, who was my dad's brother-in-law, Allison's uncle, my step-uncle, who was actually the photographer taking the pictures. And I was along just to take the orders and collect the deposits and stuff like that. So I asked him to allow me to talk to the kids. And what I told him is that you have a choice. You know, you can be the last class to have a Griffin High School ring, or you can be the first class to have a Lake Providence school ring. And we talked about it and, you know, what that would mean to them and their heritage and things like that. And afterwards, they took a vote and they voted to purchase the Griffin High School ring and be the last class that would get a ring from Griffin and not the first class to get a ring from the all-white high school. And I made that same speech and conversation in all of the schools, and every class decided to be the last class and not the first class. So we took the orders, and then we had the orders and everything was made, and it was time to go back and deliver. White principal wouldn't let us come into the school to deliver, wouldn't let us work with the kids at the school. There was only one principal that did that over in, I think it was either Hammond or Covington. And 2 weeks after he made the decision to allow us to continue to service the kids, he was fired. So my dad lost all of the schools he had outside of Orleans Parish, except for three.
So is that what?
Go ahead.
No, is that what you meant? A couple of weeks ago when we spoke, you stated that integration killed his business. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. Yes. I mean, he went from being one of the top in the industry to having almost no business. You know, he had 19 employees at one point in time, down to four or five. It was devastating to him and Potter as well. Potter eventually moved to Chicago. They wanted my father to move to Los Angeles, but because he had two families, he didn't want to move to Los Angeles. So Balfour decided to make him the national salesperson, the national sales manager for the company, which was revolutionary at that point in time.
Right.
But he was so far ahead of everybody else in the industry that they thought what he was doing would have been so profitable that they were willing to go against their feelings and hire him. His first place to go was down in Dallas, Texas, which was called Southwest Balfour at the time. And he went down there to talk to them about what he was doing with the package selling and the computerization and all of those things, and how he went about maximizing the sales. And when he left Balfour after instructing them as to what to do, they wrote Balfour a letter. That the sales manager wrote Balfour a letter, the office manager, saying that if you ever send a nigger down here to tell us how to run our business again, we'll find somebody else to make our class rings and caps and gowns and stuff. So he could not be the national sales manager for Balfour. So that's when, after another year or two, he offered to sell the business to three individuals, Edward Epps, Uncle Eddie, and Bill Ogden, who was the office manager, and me as the third person. Those two opted not to do it, and I opted to get an SBA loan and buy the business, and I ran it for the next 46 years. But I never grew it to the stature that he had, because I switched to Jostens, who had their business model was completely different from Balfour's. Balfour's business model was to hire a good salesman and let him grow as large as he could grow. Jostens was more hire 10 people and put them in a much smaller territory, and so that they could be more hands-on with each school than the Balfour's the salesman could be. Different marketing strategy. And they ended up with like 20 salesmen in Louisiana, where Balfour may have had only 6. So eventually they became the biggest company in the industry. Because it was a different marketing plan.
I'm trying to think back in college. I mean, I'm familiar with both companies. I think so. One ring along the way must have come from Balfour, and the others came from Jostens.
Yeah. Well, there were three in the industry that was very large. The Irv Jones was the other one.
That's right. Yep. Forgot about them. They're still around too. Yep.
Yep. They're still around too.
Yeah. You see them a lot on campuses these days.
Yep. They were much bigger in the college market. Jostens is the biggest one now in the industry. But yeah, and he did that. And when after he sold the business to me, he went into life insurance with New York Life and became a $1 million producer with them. And along with selling life insurance, he went with the largest real estate company in New Orleans, which was Latter & Blum. And he eventually opened his own real estate office. But again, he was more of an entrepreneur than just a salesman. And he did that for a while, came back and worked with me for about a year, right around the 1976, the bicentennial year.
Mm-hmm.
He came back and worked with me, helped me grow the business. And then he opened, what did he do after that? That's when
he opened up a restaurant. He tried to open up 2 restaurants.
Right, that's right.
He opened up Ben's in 76. And then when that didn't work, he tried another place. If I'm not mistaken, it was called Uncle Al's on corner of Claiborne and Melpomene. Tried that in 78. And then at the same time, he was dealing with he had formed Normar Corporation at the same time. And that's the part that took off in 78.
Yeah.
No, so what did that corporation do?
Normar. So he started out selling janitorial supplies, chemicals, and things of that. Matter of fact, Al, I'm glad you mentioned that, because he helped me. He came back and helped me for a year get more business. And then I turned around, and because I was in schools, I helped get him some janitorial business in the schools. And then he found a partner, Robert Donaz, who was white, and he created quite a partnership with him, and they went after a lot of co-ventures with other companies like ServiceMaster and I can't remember the names of the other ones there. But you were working with him, so you know those. His thing became, he thought that a way to the future was co-venturing with larger companies. And being, since a lot of governments and things had set asides for people that, or they had quotas that you had to meet, 30-35% doing business with minority businesses. So he became the minority partner with a lot of larger companies.
So is that Nomar still around? Is the company still in existence?
Let's see. When our father passed away, my sister Robin became the president and chief operating officer. I mean, chief executive officer, and I believe Nomar. Let's see, if I'm not mistaken, ended around, I want to say 2019. I'm not sure.
Had a good run.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Had a very good run.
Katrina took a toll on everybody.
Yes.
No more as well as Marshall Studios, because all of the schools were closed and many of the organizations that No More had business with were closed.
Right.
So I knew I had relocated to Atlanta and started calling on schools in Atlanta. Matter of fact, even before Katrina, I had started calling on schools in Atlanta and had about 7 or 8 photographic contracts in Atlanta. I couldn't do the ring business then because by contract, I didn't have the franchise to do that with Jostens. So I couldn't do that, but I could do the photography. So I had already started there. And so with that, I just figured I'd stay in the Atlanta area and grow the business there.
Okay.
I wouldn't come back after Katrina, but family wanted to come back. So I came back with family and reopened the business, but it wasn't the same. We didn't have as many schools. We had new people in the city. It was totally different. I knew it would be about 15 or so years before things got back to even close to being normal. And I'm sure it took the toll on Omar as well.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question. Was your dad able to take advantage of the GI Bill? And if so, how did he use it? Do you know?
I'm just speculating. I would have to say yes, two ways. I'm just speculating. I'd say one was probably getting a GI loan to buy a house in Pontchartrain Park, and I'm just.
That would make sense.
Yeah, and I'm thinking maybe would pay for his education at Xavier.
I would think he would have been wise enough to do that. The only difference in that is I think he would have used his GI Bill to buy the first house he had, which was on Flood Street in the Lower Ninth Ward.
Yeah, my mother did that. She did the same two things. Bought a house in D.C., which is always interesting because at that time, a single woman couldn't buy a house. You know, they wouldn't give a loan to a single woman. Yeah. So I think my grandfather co-signed with her so she could buy the house.
Yeah. And, you know, during those times, you know, not very many Blacks could own their own home.
Right.
Very few Blacks could own their own homes. But the area that he bought his first house in, the Lower Ninth Ward, was like the earlier subdivision that Blacks were actually buying homes and could afford a home. You know, later there was Pontchartrain Park, and that's where he bought his second house where Allison grew up at.
It's amazing how all those homes, I was looking, I think my mother, when she got it in the 40s, it was like under $4,000 or $5,000. And then when they sold it some decades later for $90,000, And I was looking recently at that same property. Now it's a couple $1 million in DC. So it's
wow. Well, I mean, it's all relative. You know, it just what has to happen is salaries have to keep up with the inflation of housing. You can't stop inflation. It goes up every year, but your salary, I mean, when I first started working for my dad in high school, you know, I made what, 50 cents an hour, yeah, I mean, that, you think about that, you know, a soda, what, costs 6 cents?
Right. You know? Loaf of bread was like 10 cents, 10, 12 cents. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yep. You know, so everything's relative, right?
Well, I still think that prices on certain things, especially housing, are really far outpaced salaries. So.
Well, I mean, you know, they got a lot of people making, you know, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. That's low. You know, a lot of people are making over $100,000 a year.
Yeah, but if you look at the actual percentages of people, still the average family, I think, is of two with two working adults in this country is around $75,000. That's not a lot of money, but I digress. So, do you recall any lessons that your dad learned through the service that he passed on to the family? Any values or traditions?
I would say the biggest, and Nolan, you probably agree with this one. I think when he returned stateside, he saw this advertisement and then some. And I think he passed that on to all of us directly or indirectly, meaning in so many words, you go in to do what you're told, you go beyond what you're told to do.
Okay. And then some. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then some.
Right. Yeah.
It was, you know, it's the feeling that every man is given talent. Every man has talent. It's the difference between success and failure is very little. It's in the three little words, and then some. It's those that go far beyond what they asked to do or told to do, that they go beyond that, and then some. It's three little paragraphs that he put on the back of his business cards. He also had a daily card that he'd fill out, his 10 priorities for the day. And he had that on the back of his those cards as well. And he wasn't shy about passing those out and having a long conversation about that. And I've printed it and I've given it to students in assemblies. I've passed it out, and I try to share that with I shared it with all of my kids and my grandkids, because that is so true. Every great athlete will tell you that it's those additional hours that they put in the gym, it's those additional laps that they ran, it's the additional training that they did that made the difference between them and all of the other people on the team.
That sounds like that with Golden State Warriors, Steph Curry's attitude. You know, yeah. Someone who's always underestimated because he's a little skinny guy, but it's putting in extra time going to the gym before game and going to the gym after a game.
Yeah.
Yeah. To always get better and stronger.
And it's those little skinny guys, I guess, that that have to do that, because you know? They're not big enough to just walk through the crowd and demand what they want. They have to do whatever it takes. That's what we were raised on, and punctuality, being punctual was really big. I don't know if you got that from his mother or the Marines, but he was a stickler for being on time. And Allison was raised that way. Allison is a stickler for time. Me, and not so much, until one day, because I was late almost everywhere. I try to, and not because I I'm just lazy and don't want to be there. I said, I try to do too much. I'm always doing something and it runs over. And so I'm always late for the next thing because I try to do too much with the first thing, right? So it was one of those days that I was working at my business, but I was supposed to leave and go pick my dad up at 10 o'clock and we were going to play golf. We had 10:15 tea time or something like that. And of course I was late picking him up. And of course he was standing outside with his clubs. You know? And he probably walked outside exactly at 10 o'clock. And, you know, I jumped out the car and grabbed his bag. He said, I don't need my bag. Go put my bag inside. I said, well, I mean, you know, he said, I don't feel like playing anymore. He was pissed. And I said, well, we still got time to make the tea time. He said, that's not the point. He said, you want selfish son of a, get in the car, just drive. I don't feel like playing anymore. He said, you so damn selfish. You think you're the most important person in the world. Said, you don't think I could have done something with that time I was standing out here waiting up for you? Hell, you keep the mayor of the city waiting because what you got to do is so damn important. Makes you think you that goddamn important. Boy, he read me the riot act. He just went on and on and on. And I said, well, I said, Dad, we still got time to make the tea time. He said, that's not the point, goddammit. The point is, you wasted my time. The point is, you wasted my time. Who in the hell do you think you are? That what you got to do is that so much more important than everybody else.
Well, how late were you?
15, 20 minutes.
Hey.
But the point was, you should be on time. And if you're late, you're wasting other people's time, and your time is no more important than theirs. And that was the first time that I had ever thought about it from a different perspective. I never thought about it from that perspective. I said, well, I'm not a selfish person. I've always felt that I cared about other people. And for me to be viewed as a selfish person, that went against everything for me. So from that point,
you change your ways?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think he had the desired outcome then. That was what he wanted.
Oh, he did from that day forward. Now, I can't tell you that I'm absolutely... I haven't been late for anything since then, but I'm pretty much on time every time.
Okay. So your dad had 7 children, 2 marriages. I'm interested in hearing more about the backgrounds and the careers. I know we've talked about you, and you attended Loyola, right? And then entered the family business.
Right. I attended Loyola University. My wife and I got married after a year and a half of college. She had a scholarship. I didn't. So we talked about it and agreed that it would made more sense for her to go ahead and complete her education first. And then I would go back later. And I would just work to support us while she went back to school. Of course, it never happened because by the time she finished, and it was time for me to go back to school, I took over the business at 21. I was 21 years old then. I went. I only needed to go back to school, which I did. I did go back to school at night at the University of New Orleans just to take business courses. I took, you know, everything that I thought I needed, accounting, business management. I took as much as I thought I needed to be able to run the business, and the rest is history. I ran the company for the next 46 years and okay. Raised my family and everything else.
So Allison, you went to UNO.
Yes.
Well, and then you served in the Air Force and the Air Force Reserves.
Right. I, let's see, Bachelor's of General Studies, got commissioned in, as a second lieutenant, ROTC was at UNO, so it was easy to do both. went to the Air Force Reserves. We had a reserve unit in Belle Chasse, so it was easy. It was easy for me to, I guess, to maintain dual careers at the time. And eventually got my master's in urban regional planning from UNO and went all the way up Air War College in the Air Force and became a commander in the, a group commander in, excuse me, starting off with as a squadron commander and then became a group commander later on at in Maxwell Air Force Base. But my dad saw my ceremony when I became a commander. And I didn't realize it at the time, but when he took pictures of me and my fellow commanding officers, I introduced him to my first sergeant. And he walked over to her, my black female first sergeant, and told her, well, he asked her, are you going to take care of him, right? No, he told her, you're going to take care of him, right? And she said, yes, I will. And I realized when we were saying, you know, what, you know, the impact I over the years, I saw the importance of having a good first sergeant. And when I selected to be my first sergeant, we had kind of grown up together. I grew up in the officer ranks. She grew up in the enlisted ranks. So it was pretty fitting and kind of funny that he made that statement to her. So now, she did a good job taking care of me.
Well, that's good. That's good. Now, there are five more siblings. Tell me about them.
Well, I'll start from the oldest. She became an airline stewardess back then when there were very few black airline stewardesses, and relocated to Houston, Texas, where she eventually found her significant other and Lawrence Roberts, whose father was one of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Okay.
And she married him. And they've been together ever since. They have three kids, two daughters and a son. I had my next oldest sister, because I was the baby of the three. And she became a teacher, taught all of her years in Orleans Parish School, retired. And she got married, had one daughter, got divorced, and she and her daughter lived together until her daughter passed a few years ago. She too lives now in Houston. Then there's Allison. My brother, and you can tell them about the other three.
Yeah. Well, let's see. My brother Chris worked at UNO. He wound up becoming the manager. He was the manager of Enterprise Network at University of New Orleans, and he was responsible for the university's computer, voice, and research network systems. As I said earlier, Robin became president and CEO of Nomar Corporation. And my brother, Steven, who's now deceased, became a truck driver.
Okay, so there were a total of six?
Seven,
okay. Right, mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, Cynthia's now retired, Silver's retired. I'm retired, and I was elected to the Orleans Parish School Board in 2012. I started serving in 2013. I'm still on the school board, and I plan to run one more term, which would mean I will have served 16 years if I'm successful in my fourth term. Okay. Things that I need to do to educate these kids better than what they're being educated now.
Yeah, the school boards have turned out to be quite they've come to the center of attention these days.
Yeah.
So are they banning books down there too?
No, not here.
Good. They're not doing that up where I am either. So let's talk a bit about influence and legacy. I'm wondering how your dad's experiences in the Montreal Port Marines influenced and shaped your lives and decisions. And Nolan, yours is a little bit easier because you literally followed in his footsteps. But life decisions go broader than just career. So I'm just wondering how you think his time in the service influenced and shaped your decisions, life decisions, your life and decisions.
Well, you know, I don't think that his service shaped my any of who I am. But I believe his sense of responsibility to others, to provide employment for his people and to give them opportunities and to uplift them was something that I think I took from him. Community engagement. He served on the airports board and other boards. He was civically involved. He was politically involved. I think, you know, my community engagement and involvement is again following in his footsteps. But he had some damn big footsteps. Sometimes my little feet feel like they don't fit the shoes quite the way they should. But I do think that those are things that I took from him. I learned so much watching him in the business, being around him in the business, being in sales presentations with him. How he talked to other people, how he engaged within his employees, how he cared for them, was something that I think I took much more from those experiences than I did from the experiences he had in the Marines.
Okay, Allison.
Let's see. I would say I'd say the same thing. Nolan, I was it with that Nolan just said. I saw it. I was able to more or less experience it in two different worlds. I saw it in his civic world, his business world. I also had a chance to apply it in the military. And mine was just to be honest, at least to be able to join both worlds together, be honest, be respectful, accept your responsibility for your actions. And I think one was freedom of choice. And, you know, when I told him I was joining the military, actually, he knew I was in ROTC, but I didn't tell him until 6 months before I graduated that I was being commissioned as a second lieutenant. And I think that kind of surprised him. But he gave me freedom of choice. He never said, you should do this or you should do that. He left it be my decision as to what I wanted to do. And I don't think there's any parent that would want their child to be exposed to the horrors of war. But at the same time, he did not discourage me from it. He left it basically as my decision. And I was able to look at how he operated as a business person and as a civic leader and apply that in whatever endeavor I was doing at the time. I'm retired from the Air Force Reserve, left Nomar in 2017, and now I'm a middle school science teacher. So as a priest once told me, you're given, you're a better man than me for wanting to teach middle school, and I have absolved you of all your sins in life.
Yeah, that's a tough period.
I didn't realize it until, you know, I'm going into my fifth year doing it, and I could see why he made that statement.
Yeah. Why is it that we can't figure out how to retire? But that's you know.
Yeah,
that's what,
I feel like I've never worked in my life. You know, because, you know, it's what I enjoy doing. I've had opportunities to do other things, but, you know, I always chose to do what I was doing because it never felt like work.
Well, my daughter calls me a tri-tiree because she said, I tried to retire and fail. I said, well, she said, Mom, you know, when you were thinking and planning along the way, is this how you envision retirement? I said, I envision retirement as being able to do what I choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that to choose to do nothing has no financial impact, but it's being able to choose the things that you do and not having to worry about, oh my God, am I going to pay the mortgage? Can I pay the mortgage? Can I do this? Can I do that? I said, yes, that's my idea of retirement, being able to, you know, reach out, do those service projects, take on something new, you know, adventure someplace. So
yeah.
The things that you don't get to do when you're coming along the way trying to support a family, you know.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, I looked at my father, you know, and he would never retire. I think he when he couldn't work is when he decided to let go of life, you know, because he had a heart attack when he was 55 years old. And shortly after that, another 4 years or something like that, Al, mm-hmm. he underwent
bypass surgery, something like
that. But he had five of his arteries bypassed,
mm-hmm.
and which was extensive at the time. And he had been in and out of the hospital with problems with his heart. He had a defibrillator, a pacemaker, all of those things. But as long as he could go to work, he kept fighting and doing whatever he needed to do. Now, when he could no longer drive and no longer go to work, I think is when he no longer had the will to live.
And how old was he when he passed?
79.
Okay.
So from 55 to 79, he fought a good fight. And he went to work up to, 78 hours?
Yeah.
It was that last year,
mm-hmm.
was when he didn't work. And he didn't last long after he quit working.
Yeah. Now, I always say, I don't know, we never know how long we'll be here, but the Grim Reaper, when he catches me, I'll be in motion. So it's yeah. the same kind of thing. You just keep doing. You just keep living. You know.
You know, I was. People talk about retirement. I'm retired because I don't work for a paycheck anymore.
Right.
Right. I get a stipend every month of $800 to be a school board member, and I do a few little other things to have a little money, but I don't do any of those things for the money. You know, I work like my dad because I want to do something. I want to accomplish something. And right now I'm focused on education. Once I get that fixed, then I'll go back to doing something else.
You'd be fixing that for a long time.
No, I feel like I'm really this close. I've got one piece of the puzzle left to put in place.
Okay.
If you want to do another podcast, I'll talk about
that.
Yeah, it's if I'm successful, it's a game changer.
Okay. We're keeping an ear out for what's going on down in New Orleans. Okay. So is your dad interred in a veteran cemetery or family cemetery? Just curious.
Family.
Okay. So it was a significant honor for your dad to receive a Congressional Gold Medal. What was your reaction and the reaction of your family when you found out?
I was very well pleased. I know it was well deserved. And I knew, let's see, maybe a few months earlier, I attended a seminar at the D-Day Museum that was an Air Force Academy professor who's a Black Marine, and he's in the Marine Reserves right now, Lieutenant Colonel. And he said that he didn't know about the Mumford Point Marines, even when he was going through Quantico, but he learned about it. And I think part of the reason why he didn't know about it was because, you know, he was trying to advance in his military career. He probably worked on his PhD and was working as becoming a professor either at West Point or eventually the academy. And he said he never took the time to really learn about them. And the reason why I met him back in February was because he wrote a book called, The Men of Mumford Point and the Crisis of Jim Crow. And it's supposed to be released, but I haven't seen it yet. And I think what I may do is email him to see if the book is being released. But he told me that he never really had time to learn about them because he was so busy. And ironically, I was stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base, and I was a group commander. I felt like there weren't enough hours in the day. And less than 80 miles away was the Tuskegee Airmen airfield, Moffett Field, where Tuskegee Airmen were trained. And it wasn't until this summer that I took a weekend trip, went up there, looked at everything that they went through, got a chance to see Moffett Field, got a chance to walk around all the facilities that were still there. And it was gratifying to see all of that. I'm sorry I didn't get to do it when I was on active duty, but I felt that my career was I was able to go ahead and close out my career by going up there and actually seeing everything that the Tuskegee Airmen did. And it was very similar to what our dad went through when they went through the training. They were not wanted. They had to get a presidential executive order to admit African Americans in the military, in the Marine Corps. And for them to go through all of that, earn their way being in the Pacific, fighting, going through the fighting, the same training, and helping to secure the Pacific battlefield, and then later on coming back and not being recognized, taking almost 80 years for them to be recognized, was really a powerful event and statement. And when I was at the Tuskegee exhibit, in the gift shop, they had several pictures. And one of them was pictures of the Tuskegee Airmen. And beneath it was a quote that said, "The ultimate judge of a person's character is their ability to exceed expectation when little recognition or praise is given." And there was no doubt in my mind that the Mumford Point Marines not only laid the foundation for just about any African-American officer to serve, but also to be finally recognized for their service was truly, truly an emotional and remarkable event.
Well said.
I've always been very proud of my father. He's an exceptional individual. You don't make many like him. He was the epitome of and then some. Me knowing him was all the everything for me. You know, the gold medal and everything is like icing on the cake. You know, I enjoyed the cake, right? I enjoyed every my whole life with my dad. He taught me how to fish, taught me how to play golf, how to catch a football. All of those things are just cherished memories. And spent a lot of quality time with him. You know, he's one hell of a man. One hell of a man. I didn't need the gold medal to tell me that.
I didn't need
the gold medal to tell me that. And my timeline is always looking forward. You know, what can I do tomorrow? Who can I help? What can I do? How can I make things better tomorrow? So looking back is not something that I do very often. But to make me stop and look back at my dad's life was, and for other people to appreciate him and those other men is time well spent. Time well spent. I really appreciate it.
So I have one final question for you, for both of you. What lessons from your dad's life story can you share to inspire young African Americans to embrace fears, opportunities, so they can break those glass ceilings and be their best selves?
It's you're in the classroom with them every day, so you talk to them every day.
And, I would say you're going to have to persevere. You know that thing that. Yes, you have things a lot easier now than generations had it before, but it's still your responsibility to exercise that right and to move forward. And I don't give my students opportunities to whine and complain. I know that they're young, they're impressionable, but one of the things that infuriates me in the classroom is that they will write down on a test question, IDK, I don't know. And I say, that is not acceptable.
No.
That is not acceptable. Try. And I will literally stand over them and say, give me an answer. That one is not acceptable. Use your brain, especially if they're in eighth grade is going in high school. So they have to understand that they have to keep moving forward. They have to learn. They have to do their very best. And If I show anger in the classroom is when they do not try. And in many respects, they have it a lot easier than when I was in school, even though I went to private school, but I will push them to try.
They don't even know they have it easier, actually.
No, so. No.
So Nolan?
Well. There's a fallacy in what we're doing. Many people think it's enough to be financially responsible and take care of your responsibilities. But for us to reach the promise of this democracy, it requires that all citizens are educated, they're informed, and they are engaged. Democracy requires engagement to succeed. And without that, you have what you have now. You have opportunists taking advantage of our differences. And we are the most diverse country in the world. But they prey on our differences to keep us divided and to keep themselves in power. And that power comes along the riches of power. But we'll never reach our goals and our objectives as leaders of the free world until we truly unleash the human potential of all of our citizens. Because that's when we, it's competition that sharpens the knife. It's going against the best. And democracy and capitalism in this country requires competition. When you get people that create monopolies and things, that's when we don't work, we don't strive. We got a long way to go for people, this country, to realize that our most important resource in this country, in this world, is human resources.
Human capital, yes, absolutely.
Human resources. And when we allow all of our human resources to work towards reaching their potential, it's when we really are at our best. We are truly at our best when everybody is working hard. You'll get the better doctors, better lawyers, everybody, when there's real competition. And we should be exporting our human resources throughout the world. We should be investing in other countries, and our best and brightest should be running businesses, creating economic opportunities in other countries, helping other countries to build and develop. You know, we could do that. And it would be an experience for a young person coming out of college to go take a managerial position at a startup in Belize, or a startup in Bolivia, or somewhere else in the world, and getting to honing their skills and things, and then maybe returning home to do something at a higher level. But the world is a small place, and it's growing smaller. And when we realize that developing the human resources in your community and your world, in this nation, and in the world, should be the goal. Trying to keep people down or oppress people or taking economic advantage of people does not get us anywhere. It just causes the wars and the selfishness throughout the world that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So,
That's what I do every day. Talk about these kinds of things, and when I say I'm this close, I'm this close to engaging this community in the education of our children.
Well, we'll have to have a whole nother conversation about that.
When you have a 2-hour long podcast, give me some space to talk about it.
Okay, yeah, because I want to learn some tips to maybe kind of apply them where in the other regions of the country, you know.
Well, we're getting there.
Start small. With guys, Allison and Nolan, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight and for sharing your family story and your other points of wisdom with me and with the audience. I'm very, very grateful for the time we've had together here.
You're more than welcome, Doctor.
I enjoyed it. I look forward to seeing your podcast, and I look forward to seeing some of your other podcasts. Do you do any podcasts around education
at all? No, but this is my only podcast. This is my only podcast. So, but you okay. know, we'll see what this is. This is a relatively new venture, so we'll see where it goes. You got to start someplace.
Well, you know, I'm gonna.
And actually, no, I do say that because this is about education. The whole intent of this was connecting the different generations. But go ahead, you had a different point.
Well, it's just that people are talking to me about doing a podcast around education.
Okay,
and my views of education.
Well, let's talk offline. I can tell you how I kind of arrived at this place, because it took me a while, about a year or so, to figure out what I wanted to do. And, okay. So. All right, gentlemen, thank you, and happy holidays.
Same to you. Thank you.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. During a period when some wished to erase history and ban books, I will share a quote from Lieutenant Colonel Allen West. History is not there for you to like or dislike. It's there for you to learn from. And if it offends you, even better, because then you'll be less likely to repeat it. It's not yours to erase. It belongs to all of us. See you for our next show on Wednesday, February the 7th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, New York City Podcast Network, and Spotify for Podcasters.